Welcome to the Extensive Reading Podcast, our second episode. I'm Travis. Here alongside me is
Jose.
Jose, and today we have a great episode lined up for you. We're interviewing Mark Brierley.
From Shinshu University in Nagano.
Here in Japan.
He'll be joining us on Skype.
Yeah, so we're really looking forward to that. We're hoping to have a lot of interesting topics, and we've prepared a lot of questions that we hope to get through, and we'll see how it goes. Okay, so something else I would like to do today, if I have your permission here.
You have
here.
My approval. Yeah, no
problem. I'd like to introduce a segment, and I'll play the drop here now.
Continuing the debate. Really?
So what I like to get at here is last week we kind of started to butt heads a little bit on input, on the role of input, on maybe specifically Krashen, on learning versus acquisition, what's the difference? And so I thought, well, we have maybe kind of different opinions about this. And I think it's something that I'm sure a lot of different teachers also have varying opinions on. So why not continue the debate right here?
I'm ready.
And so what I propose is each episode, either you or I, this week I'll start, bring in an article to continue the debate and see what they say on things like implicit versus explicit learning, on the role of input, on really anything that you can think really furthers your beliefs on how language is acquired.
Sure. Ready?
Are you ready?
Yeah, I was going to say, not only articles, but maybe we can find the actual voices.
That'd be fantastic. I think that'd be
wonderful. I'm just warning you, I'm bringing Krashen.
Well, funny you should mention Krashen, because what I have brought today is Meryl Swain, and she had, published
the output hypothesis.
Numerous articles on the output hypothesis, and this is a direct response to Krashen's input hypothesis. And what she found in teaching French immersion students in Canada was that even with years of comprehensible input, by the end of it, the students, she felt, were still lacking in the ability to produce the language in a meaningful way. And I think what this shows is that input alone, and this is what she said, is insufficient in acquiring a language.
I'm happy that you said acquiring the language, not learning the language.
Okay. Really, I'm watching myself here. And basically, I think there are five main functions of output and how it supports second language acquisition, and just how when you're producing a language, it has a noticing and triggering function. And so you're noticing what you're producing. You're noticing maybe even gaps in your language and what you know. And that can help with developing accuracy. And along with Swain Izumi, maybe somebody I'll bring in later, mentions how you can process language more deeply. Furthermore, output supports SLA and like a hypothesis testing function. And so that idea that maybe you have an idea on how the language works and you're having an opportunity to test it out in conversation and output and maybe even receive feedback from your interlocutor if that's correct.
Whereas if you don't interact, it wouldn't just appear. Yeah.
Yeah. Developing a personal voice, I think that's kind of explanatory. Just output as a necessary part of interaction. And output enhances productive fluency, where I think input, certainly there's fluency in reading fluency or in listening fluency, but maybe that doesn't necessarily mean you're fluent in how you speak. And then finally, just a metalinguistic function, And learners using language to negotiate form, to talk about the target language. Swain later goes in and talks more about languaging and language-related episodes and interacting with the language from a metalinguistic kind of point of view.
Yeah, it's harder to imagine how you can develop knowledge of the speech acts that you need to interrupt somebody or to apologize for something if you're not using. I totally see your point.
You're supposed to debate me.
I'll see you next week.
Good. Okay. Well, yeah. I don't want this segment to run so long, but if you have any comments, anything else you'd want to add?
Well, you kind of get me off guard here, right? I would have to read her article.
I know.
Her articles. And the 1985 article is really hard to find. Mm. I've been through this before, and I've read the 1993 one, and then I've read references to the 1985. I think it's the 1985.
The 85. First one. That's right.
And I've never been able to read that one so I can talk properly about it. But of course, like, the first word is noticing, so that implies, I mean, if it's acquisition, then it's not something that you notice because it's supposed to be unconscious. So the moment you say noticing, that involves learning.
And yeah.
Then there's the,
And somebody else who I do plan to bring in, not to reveal my cards in my hand.
Schmidt. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend you to do that.
No,
that's so easy to, we'll see what happens.
I know, we'll get into that in a different episode, but.
I can't fight the mainstream. Like, from your perspective, it's really comfortable because you've been, like, you're supporting the middle term and the conservative position, if you will. The one that there's more agreement on.
It's not radical.
Right. But my position is seen as radical, as controversial, and I'll be an exhibitionist. I'll run this risk.
Good, but I think it's, and part of the reason my motivation for continuing a program like this is, I don't think it should be radical, your position. I think a lot of people, when they read Swain, they feel like, okay, throw away Krashen, throw away input mm-hmm. hypothesis. And I don't think that was her intention either. Input alone is insufficient, but that doesn't mean you should get rid of input or that you should lessen the importance or the role of it. And so I think these things you should find a balance with them. And I think that's how you're going to acquire language.
Okay.
That's me. Looking forward to next week.
Okay, we're here with Mark Barley, who teaches at Shinshu University in Matsumoto City in Nagano. And he's been running an extensive reading program there since 2005, so for a really long time. Mark is also a visible person in the ER circles here in Japan, a visible figure at the extensive reading JOLT SIG, Special Interest Group. He created the Extensive Reading Foundation's online self-placement test, and he participates in many ER-related events. Mark's editor of the Extensive Reading in Japan journal and copy editor of the Journal of Extensive Reading. And two of his most recent articles on extensive reading are Who Killed Extensive Reading? Round Up the Usual Suspects. And Why Extensive Reading? 7 Reasons. And I'm done. I hope it was all okay.
Is that right? Any corrections?
Thank you.
For...
No, thank you. Thank you. That's wonderful.
Yeah, well, thank you again for joining us.
It's been great to be here.
Yeah. Thank you again for a couple of weeks ago joining us down in Nara, too. We really appreciate that.
Yep, that was a good, great audience. It's great to speak to people interested in what you're talking about.
Speaking about being interested in ER, what's your story? How did you get involved with extensive reading? Or what led you down that path?
I suppose I've always thought something was wrong with language teaching. And I think that probably even goes back to when I was at school in England, learning to speak French. And my school, school headmistress was a French teacher, so I studied French from quite a young age. And we had this exchange student from France. This kid had come over from France, and I think he was in my brother's year, so he was a bit older than me. And he'd failed his French test at school, and he had to go into school on Saturday morning for a detention, and because he'd failed his French test for the present perfect or something.
Yeah, can see that.
At that point, I thought, wait, something's wrong with language education if we have people who speak French and are from France coming over and failing our French exams. So I ended up becoming an English teacher, and I teach now at university, and quite often I'll ask kids, do you speak English?
Mm.
And these are people who've studied for at least 6 years, and a lot of them say no.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So you kind of, I wonder, what have you been doing for the last 6 years?
Yeah, you'd mentioned in one of your papers how in 6 years, so many students have replied that they've read a English book or an English book, yeah. or hardly even.
Yeah, most of my, I do is one thing I regularly ask my students, how many books have you read? And it's when I started, actually, it was about half the students had not read a single book by the time they get to. And my university is not a bad university, so it's not as if these who've never studied English, they have to pass the English exam to get into the school, so they're relatively good students. So I saw a presentation by Rob Waring, and he showed, there was actually just one graph that he showed of the frequency of English words, and you may have seen this graph.
Yeah, we read your articles.
And it's just there are a very small number of very frequent words.
Yeah.
And just looking at that, it's very, very obvious that there are a few words that are very, very important. And our students basically need to know those very important words. And they need to know them not only, I think there's an idea about vocabulary that people just need to know lots of words.
Yeah,
and I think that's obviously if you know more words is better, but I think often the depth of vocabulary is forgotten, and people just try to add up, like, know a little bit about thousands and thousands of words, when really you just need to know a few hundred words very well. And that's so this just kind of, it made me realize that what the students basically, and it's really very, very simple. They need to just do English, basically. If they don't, it's like anything. If they don't
do it, right?
They don't do it, they're not gonna get good. And just actually, I was thinking about Eric Clapton the other day. I'm not a big Eric Clapton fan, but I think he first picked up a guitar when he was, I think 5 years after he first picked up a guitar, he was acclaimed as the greatest guitarist in the world. And that's 5 years. And my students have all studied English for at least 6 years. So they, you know, longer than
Eric, played the Eric guitar, yeah.
not just to learn how to play, but to become the greatest
guitarist in the world.
So there's obviously something wrong with the way that education takes place. And as I said, this is not really a Japan problem. I think it's just a language teaching problem. That we're in a very we have a very high failure rate in our profession. I think if we were doing anything else, then people would probably shut us down.
And you think, obviously, you think the answer to whatever failure is more input.
Yeah, obviously more whether input alone is enough is an interesting question. I think the important thing is that it's not a question of whether input alone is enough, but switch it around? And how about having no input? Can you become good at English with zero input? And the answer is obviously no.
No.
So they just need more. They need more input. We need input to become good at a language. And I think reading is it's not the only way, but it's if you're stuck in the middle of Japan, surrounded by other people who speak Japanese, and you switch on the TV and it's Japanese, then books, reading books is a very easy, portable way to get into the language. So it seems like the best way, probably the best way for most of our students to get that input.
Sorry, can I ask a question? How do you go from the realization that students need to really know in depth a few hundred words or the most frequent 1,000 words to the idea that the best way to accomplish that is through extensive reading? Because it could be done otherwise, right? You could come to that realization and then think, okay, we're going to have to drill these students on these words, but you didn't. Was that in Rob Waring already, or
I think there's a context is really, really important. Mm. And let me tell you another story. When I I used to teach in Eikaiwa, so I'd teach in this school where there was a high school student who was sitting in the school in the reception waiting for his lesson, and he was doing his homework, and he was writing out words as high school students do, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think he was writing the word curiosity, and he'd written curiosity about 10 times, and I was like looking over his shoulder, and he looked at me and said, oh, what does curiosity do? And so he'd been writing this word out loads of times, and he was I guess he was learning the spelling, but he had no idea what the word meant.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that's kind of the opposite of what extensive reading, which is that the whole thing is context. Words don't, they're not just these isolated bits of knowledge. They're not isolated bits of information. They're all connected with them. They're connected with other words. And if you want to be a translator and you want to translate the word from English, or if you want to do well in spelling tests, then that approach may be okay. But to be able to use English, you need to know how do these words work in relation to other English words,
mm-hmm.
in relation to meanings and discourses that happen in English. So you need it's authentic. You need authentic language, and I think learning by rote is often not really authentic.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. certainly, just reading your work, you'd mentioned about the role of collocations and even multi-word units and getting exposure to those things is, I agree, I think that's really important, and I think you can do that through extensive reading. In our episode last week, that was kind of a gap that we didn't really address, is what is a graded reader?
So a graded reader basically is a book that has been written with controlled level of vocabulary. And in fact, all books are written with controlled levels of vocabulary. And there's a process called editing, which the author or somebody else takes the author's work and they go through it and think, oh, this word shouldn't be here. All texts are written with a particular audience in mind.
Absolutely. And
it may be written for adults. It may be written for well-educated adults. It may be written for less educated adults. It may be written for children, for teenagers, for very young children. So every single book that you pick up is targeted at some audience. And in fact, there are even examples of some Alice in Wonderland, which you may know about, was written for one person.
Mm.
It's a book that was written for one particular girl. And so that's a very extreme case of a book. But I'm sure it's not unusual that books are probably quite often written with one specific reader in mind.
In mind, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So in the case of graded readers, these books have either been written from scratch, deliberately aimed at a particular language learner with a particular vocabulary, or they may have been adapted. So a work has been taken that's already written. Phantom of the Opera, for example, I think has been put into graded readers about 14 times. And it's enough. I think we don't need it. They keep we've got enough Phantom of the Opera. We don't, if anyone's listening, don't.
Authors listening.
If I were to use, I mean, for my students at a junior high school, would you recommend graded readers written for students of English, or would you recommend children's books written for native English speaking children, or both? Which are the relative advantages of each of them?
I think for the big difference with native speaking children is that they have actually quite a big vocabulary. So I think we learn about 1,000 words per year. So if by the age of 20, you know about 20,000 words, by the age of 5, you know about 5,000 words. So when native speakers are starting to learn how to read, they already know about 5,000 English words. And the process then for a native speaker is just to kind of decode the words into the word that they already know. So they know what the word is. And this, whereas for a non-native speaker, for your junior high schools, they may have just started learning English and they may not know the word at all. So they're kind of learning the other way around. They're often learning words the first time they
see these words is on the text. Yeah.
Written, right. So they're coming from a different angle and they don't have a vocabulary of 5,000 English words.
Plus the grammar, of course.
And the grammar, right, yeah. But also the words, that there are a lot of words, for example, phrasal verbs, where you have like put off or put on or put up with or put over or get on or get off or get away with. And there are literally thousands of combinations of very, very common, very short words that will probably completely baffle most non-native and even some quite good users of English, some quite proficient users of English, may be completely baffled with something like get off with, which most native speakers would know what that means. But I'm sure a lot of non-native speakers have no idea what get off with means. And that's three very, very simple words that a five-year-old can probably read. So that's the big difference with perhaps paradoxically, I wouldn't recommend children's books for beginner learners of English in Japan. Unless they're kind of picture books with single words in.
I think, a natural step that we talked about, with graded readers, I think one of the big challenges in starting an ER program is just building a library of graded readers. I know you have experience firsthand doing that and starting from scratch and then moving it into a library. Can you tell us about that process?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That was... I came back from the Rob Waring lecture, fired up and wanting to do something with this wonderful idea, which I hadn't really heard about. I hadn't heard of the idea of graded readers. Another colleague is a big Crashen fan, a big fan of the input hypothesis. And we were just in a situation where we basically both decided we should start doing some graded readers. And so we need to get some books, and we had no money. But our students always buy textbooks. So we thought, well, instead of getting our students to buy a textbook, we'll get them to buy a couple of graded readers. And actually they'll be happy because the graded readers are much cheaper textbooks. So we had a few kind of samples that we got and we got each of our students, then we got these catalogs from the publishers, and the publishers are very happy to send catalogs. And we showed them to our students, and we worked out this, basically we get the students into groups of four or something and get them to look through some catalogs and to choose books that they wanted to read. And then we'd get them to put some money together and go off to the university shop and put an order in to get these graded readers. And so that was how we started buying the book, or started getting the students to buy the books. And then what we'd do is we'd kind of pool the books that we had. So we had a bit of a float to start with from books that we'd got, we'd begged and borrowed and got as samples. And then the students each bought a book. And then what we did when they finished reading their first book, we'd get them to put their book into the class libraries.
Yeah.
And at this stage, I say class library, they were cardboard boxes that we used to carry.
That's what I do every day.
And so sometimes it'd be like in a different faculty, or we'd be kind of walking through the snow with our boxes full of books. And we got them. So they then, once they had a book, they'd then put their book in, and then they could borrow another book. So we worked out all these lending sheets and this lending system. And that was kind of quite fun. So we just built up the library. And what happened then, a year or so later, well, we got another few teachers interested in what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a new curriculum coming in. And we graded reading, extensive reading became part of this new curriculum. So a year or two later, suddenly we had 2,000 students all doing extensive reading. And we were still using the same system of getting 2,000. So we had about 40 classes or 50 classes or whatever.
Yikes. And
all these teachers we were working with, and these systems that were, so we were trying to get everyone to follow this system where they'd be getting their students to look through the catalogs, and we kind of got order forms written out so that they could hand out these order forms to the students, so the students took the order forms. And it got to the point that we kind of went to the university bookshop and said, could we just order a load of books and get the students to come here and buy them off the shelf? And at first that had been an impossible idea. And the university shop's kind of, it works not so much as a bookshop. It's more, they seem very scared of having any stock. So they basically want to buy, if there are 20 students in the class, they want to buy exactly 20 books.
20 textbooks, yeah.
Need the students to come and buy one book. And if there's any books left over, they want to be able to send them back to the publisher and get, and not have to pay the extra stock. So by the time we had 2,000 students coming in twice a year to the shop with their like handwritten, scratchy order forms, which the bookshop then had to process these hundreds of bits of paper and put in the orders for these. They thought, oh yeah, it would be easier actually if you just give us a list of books and we'll send the order off. And then we could, that was much better because we would get, we tried to get the students to get the right level book. And also, again, we didn't want, we do actually still have hundreds of copies of Phantom of the Opera because so many students would order that book. And even if we tried to mitigate it by getting the groups to each choose a different book. But even so, each class you'd get like at least one person from each group would order
Phantom of the Opera.
So for a while we had a kind of no Phantom of the Opera in the bookshop because we had enough Phantoms of the Opera. So then we were in a much better situation. We could then control exactly which books would go into our library. And we were still working on the class library system. We'd got some budget, so we now had trolleys which we could put our books on. Books who'd go on the book trolleys, and we'd be wheeling these trolleys around. And we had all these systems for which trolleys should go into which classroom at which time, and we had borrowing sheets for the trolleys. And everything was working fairly well. But we were losing I think we lost a couple of thousand books one year. And we then started to think, well, it'd be really good if we could put these books in the library instead of us having to, because teachers are not librarians. Librarians are very good at looking after books, and teachers aren't. Teachers are very kind, generous people. And if you give a trolley full of books to a teacher and get a class there, then sooner or later there'll be no books left on the trolley. So we then got another thing that happened around that time is we Sakai Sensei. I don't know if you know, you've come across Sakai Sensei.
The three rules.
The million book. The million book Tadoku, Hyakumango Tadoku. Mm-hmm. And he came to talk to us one time. He's also a big Crescian fan, and very interesting, somewhat controversial, but very, very interesting person. And he came and he looked at our book, and we were very proud of our selection of books that we now had. I think we were still on the trolleys now. And we'd also tried to control for level, so we'd get the students to buy the right level book, so they'd be reading at the right level. And he came and looked at our books, and he said, where are the starters? Well, these books are far too difficult. Mm. And we'd been worried that we were getting, you know, we have university students, we're getting level one books. And we were kind of worried that level one books were too difficult for our students. And Sakai Sensei came and was shocked that these books were far too difficult for our students. So we started getting starters,
mm-hmm,
as well. And some of which are comics. And I remember one of my classes, I had some students who were, most of my students are not English majors, and English is not their favorite subject. And I remember one student seeing the starters, and he was so happy to see, he opened the book, and it was one of the, I think it was an Oxford starter, one of the cartoon ones. And he was just so happy to see a book that was easy for him to read. So we were in the situation of having getting the books into the library. And all the books that we had. And what we did was when the students bought a book for our system, we encouraged them to donate the book at the end of the year. And we made it we twisted their arm a bit by saying we kept a record of which book they bought, and that we told them that they could come and reclaim the book they bought kind of at 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning. In a classroom on the fourth floor.
You need to climb this mountain, and the book will be in a box at the top of it, and you can reclaim it.
Yeah. But at the same time, we found that one of the teachers was actually getting the books, was taking the books that his students had bought, keeping them on a shelf in his room.
Mm.
And then and lending the other students' books to his students, and then giving all the books back to his students at the end of the year. So that wasn't so successful. But then we got the books into the library. And when we started actually looking at it, there are funds and grants, and there's all sorts of money available for buying books for libraries, which once we started talking to the library, and the library was very, very happy to have our books in the library. So what we do now is the students, they don't need to buy a book. They can just go to the library and borrow books. And it's much, much easier. But at the same time, it was a bit sad not having the books in class. And I think there was something about having, making the system and actually having the books in class and getting students. So sometimes you'd have students on library duty, so they'd be, and sometimes you'd get them to take the books off the trolley and spread them out on tables so that people could come and look and kind of browse over the books. So that whole experience with the books was kind of lost when we sent the books to the library. But it makes it much, much, much easier to handle.
And just the immediacy, I mean, I know one of like the tenets of extensive reading is if you're not enjoying it or if it's too difficult, find another book. And just being able to, oh, well, the other books are right on the table over there.
Yeah.
I can.
Yeah, because I do that. And I always, like, even now, I always bring a few books to class. And yeah, well, usually if they've left their book at home, I lend them one of my books. And if they haven't borrowed a book, I send them to the library.
Get out of here. Go to the library.
I tell them to run. And I sometimes teach them. I look out the window and check.
Here's the timer. You start the timer. You got 3 minutes, right?
Yeah, but they should. You know, they need to run to the library, and then they need to stop and actually properly, because a lot of the students don't really look for books. Mm. They just
get any book,
pick up the first thing that they see, which is a problem. I mean, something that getting them to spend more time looking through books is another thing that you can control more when they're browsing in class, and when they're looking through books, they're kind of talking to each other about how the books are, and the whole experience is a bit better. And even now, what I'd like is, if they do have a book and I tell them, if it's boring, stop reading, get another book. And I tell them I have books in class, but almost never does a student
stop reading a book they find boring.
Stop reading and say, they'll never come up to me. I sometimes go and, you know, you're looking a bit sleepy. Is this book interesting? Or, you know, you're reading them. You're trying to read Harry Potter, and, you know, isn't it a bit difficult?
This is kind of out of your level, right?
Yeah, we've been, it's 15 minutes into reading time and you're still on page one. Are you sure you know what's in the book over there?
Could you tell us about the advantages of having students read in class? Like that would be one of the advantages. I think many people would prefer, or there's a situation where you cannot have sustained silent reading in class. I think it happens to many people who are implementing ER programs.
Yeah, I think the main thing is just, if you do it in class, the students think it's important.
Mm.
That's basically it. I mean, that's the main justification, is that it's something that the students need to do. So if you spend class time on it, that's a signal that, hey, this is worth doing. It's so important. We're actually going to do it in our English lesson instead of all the other things that I know my students don't think are important. So that's about, I think there's kind of political. Well, I mean, the other advantages are, like we've been saying, you can actually monitor the students' reading.
Mm.
You can see whether there's no physical way that you can be sure a student is reading. It's sure. Impossible. But you can at least see whether they're going through the motions. You can see which books they're choosing. And I also do things in class, like I measure reading speed. So I get to measure how fast they're reading the book that they're actually reading, because it's important. I think measuring reading speed as an abstract ability is useful, but it's much more important to know, well, how fast are you actually reading the book that you've chosen?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of spend some time going through, well, if you're reading less than 60 words a minute, that's going to be pretty painful. And so you can do lots of, if you do reading in class, you guarantee each student has brought a book with them. So you can see what they're reading. And you can then do lots of expansion activities based around those books. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one thing I do, and actually the first time I heard this, I thought it was a ridiculous idea, is to get the students to read aloud.
Mm.
Because, and I say at first I thought that was crazy, because reading should be a quiet kind of personal experience that our students are enjoying. But I tried it, and one thing you can also, if you go around listening, you can kind of hear as well, if it's a book that is out of their league, then it really shows when they're reading the book aloud. And I get them to all read aloud at the same time, so no one's listening to them except me.
Yeah.
And you can see, so things like that you can do. There's lots of activities you can do relating to the books. If you get reading in class, get them to bring the books.
That'll be a topic for another interview. That's for the next interview with Mark.
We'll keep that's for part two, right?
We'll keep bothering you.
Yep, anytime.
That was Mark Riley. Thanks again, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. That was wonderful.
So for next week, we have somebody who's a very, very special person within the ER community. That's Professor Atsuko Takase, who's been researching student motivation in extensive reading for a pretty long time now, and teacher's attitudes towards extensive reading, and who will be the co-chair of the conferences at the Extensive Reading World Congress, the fourth Extensive Reading World Congress this summer in Tokyo.
Great. So, we're looking forward to it. So stay tuned. We'll be back next week with that. And
of course, if you have any questions it'd be great if you sent us questions for Professor Takase.
Yeah.
You can just send your questions to our email address.
What is that email address?
No, email address.
I believe it is. Let me test me. Here it is. EX.
That's it. It's EX.
EX.
R.
R. Podcast at gmail.com.
That's right.
EXRpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, so any comments about the program, any suggestions, any if you think we should be interviewing this or that person or dealing with this or that topic, please send us an email. It'd be great if you could send us a voice file, an MP3 file.
Yeah.
You can just record yourself on your mobile phone, or you can use the latest technology if you're really into that.
We'd love to hear from you in any form.
And of course, yeah, so general questions or comments about the program or specific material for our guest, which for the next episode will be Professor Atsuko Takase. And yeah, maybe the following episode, well, it's not for sure yet, but at some point we would like to interview Tom Robb, who's the other co-chair of the Extensive Reading World Congress. So if you have any questions for him, you can already...
Yeah, I've talked to him just last week, and he said he's more than willing to talk to us. We just have to find the right day. So we're looking forward to that, too, hopefully in the next week or so. So that about covers it for us.
I think we're done.
Yeah, for Jose and myself, happy reading.